This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture, with me, Neil Denny. This week, historian Greg Jenner talks about his book, A Million Years in a Day, a curious history of everyday life from the Stone Age to the Phone Age. Greg Jenner is the historical consultant to CBBC's multi-award-winning Horrible Histories, Horrible Histories with Stephen Fry, and various Horrible Histories spin-offs, as well as contributing sketches and co-writing Stephen Fry's links. Over the past 4 years, he has been solely responsible for the factual accuracy of nearly 1,000 comedy sketches with subject matter that spans the entirety of human history. Greg studied at the University of York, and after dropping the initial plans for a life in academia, has worked on historical documentaries and dramas for the past 7 years. And Greg's first book, which we're going to be talking about today, is A Million Years in a Day, A Curious History of Everyday Life from the Stone Age to the Phone Age. Greg, thank you very much for coming on Little Atoms, first of all.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
It's a pleasure to have you. So I want to talk, first of all, before we get onto the book, about what does a historical consultant on TV actually do?
That's a good question. There aren't many of us about, really. We're quite a rare breed. I suppose what we're trying to do is we're kind of the compromise merchants, mm-hmm. in that we have to liaise with the key talent who are making a programme, and you have to advise them on what would be the best thing to do in terms of communicating historical truths, and they will then say, yeah, I don't want to do that.
Yes.
You're ruining my really lovely drama. And so quite often what you're doing, I suppose, is trying to find ways of saying, well, can you try this instead of that? Could we soften this? Could we try and be a little bit more subtle here? Because really, obviously, my job is to try and improve the quality of historical understanding in a show, try and make it more accurate, more reliable, more closer to the truth. But obviously their job is to make a really interesting, engaging, entertaining programme. And if it's a drama, then you obviously want it to be really entertaining. And even if it's a documentary, you still want it to be watchable. You know, no one wants to watch a really dull 60-minute documentary.
I was going to say, like, you've answered it really by calling it compromise. You know, how much sway do you have? Because obviously, as well as just somebody not wanting to change their lovely words or whatever, there's budget constraints and things. I mean, when did telly start thinking that this was an important thing to do? Because it's obviously not always been the case.
No, that's a very interesting question. I think television had a relatively early relationship with expertise back in the 60s. Certainly back then, the history programmes were very much fronted by proper professors with moustaches who would sit there in their tweed, and they would, you know, very much talk to you about the Neolithic. And what then later on happened is the emergence of ITV and the emergence of commercial channels. You start to see the move towards having people who are quite good at presenting stuff. So you then move towards professional presenters being handed scripts written for them by researchers who've read some books about history. In terms of historical consultancy, I mean, in the 80s, there were quite a lot of history movies that had consultants working on them, but Hollywood often didn't really bother with them. And also, would use that as a weapon to a certain extent. They'd say, our film has a historical consultant, but they wouldn't have listened to them. They just would have paid them some money and then said, just stand there and look. Legitimate us, you know, make us look like we've taken this seriously, but we haven't. And certainly, I think, in the 2000s, we've seen, I think, a much bigger intake of experts advising on dramas and movies now. So I know a lot of people who have advised on BBC costume dramas, you know, if it's Jane Austen style stuff or if it's Wolf Hall or what, you know, it's much more common now. And the good thing is, generally speaking, the person brought onto that project is usually an expert in that period. I'm a bit different in that I'm not an expert in a period. I'm a generalist, really. I mean, I trained as a medievalist, but I kind of do a bit of everything. So my training actually is in a slightly different aspect. I train really more as a public historian, and that's a very boring way of saying that what I try to do is mediate the much more complicated elements of what academic history is and find ways to communicate that to as broader an audience as possible. And so I'm interested in the conversation between the very austere, intellectualised world of historians, which is very important. It's a very, you know, it's obviously, history is a field, a discipline where people are desperately seeking to try and find out what happened in the past. It's a rigorous intellectual discipline full of great ideas and arguments and debates. And then, of course, you've got telly, which is not really very good at that at all. Telly is much more superficial and a bit more of a, to some extent, you could say TV is more of a distraction or a pastime than it is an actual intellectual pursuit. And so as a public historian, you try to find the ways of bringing the difficult to the many and say, okay, this is really important, and we're going to try and distill it down for you as simple as possible.
But history itself, the study of history itself, has also followed that. You know, you described the idea of, you know, the old telehistorians being someone like, you know, Kenneth Clark or whatever in Tweed, and now it's supposed to be a lot less patrician. I mean, I'm sure in a lot of ways it still is, but the study of history itself has also undergone a change over recent years. So what does it mean to be a historian now?
Well, I think you're right. I think there's been a sea change. Certainly I've noticed it. On Twitter, there are so many, what we call ourselves Twitterstorians. There's probably a better pun, but that's the one we seem to have settled on. Twistorians? I don't know. There are so many, and a lot of them actually are not necessarily even that young. You know, there's loads of PhD students and early career researchers, but there's actually a lot of very eminent professors and people in the middle of their career who are on Twitter and having a brilliant time blogging about their subject and engaging with the public. That, I think, is the result of about 10 years or so of a kind of attitude shift in universities. I think there was definitely that ivory tower problem before, and I think that may have been more the actual universities themselves being quite scared, perhaps. I'm not sure. I don't know if it was a historical community being quite nervous. I believe Simon Sharma found it very difficult initially when he made the History of Britain a good 15 years ago. I think initially a lot of people looked at him and said, what are you doing?
Yeah.
What are you doing on telly? I mean, that's not what we do. You know, we're great.
Sort of what happened to Carl Sagan as well.
Yeah, exactly.
The science world.
Precisely. And, yeah. You know, Carl Sagan stepped out of that bubble and said, well, you know, there's 200 million Americans over there and they want to know about the cosmos. I'm going to go tell them. And so I think there's been a big change in history now where a lot of people are saying, okay, you know what, actually this matters, this is relevant, this is important, how can I try and bring what I do to the public? And some of that I think is probably universities saying, you know what, you need to justify your salaries and you need to justify our existence. You know, we need to be front-facing, we are a public institution, we derive some funding from the government. So maybe there's a kind of an angle there that is more to do with accountability and just being part of the wider community. But also I think certainly the majority of the historians I speak to, they're so passionate about their subject. They love it. They think it's extraordinary. Why wouldn't they have dedicated their life to it? And they want to share it with people. And I think perhaps before they weren't really allowed to, and now they can. So they're on Twitter, they're on Facebook, they're on telly, they're on the radio. They're out there talking about what it is they do. And obviously my job, to a certain extent sometimes, is to point them in the right direction or ask them for help when I'm doing a project and bring them on board. So it's really nice. There's a lovely Twitter community. In fact, all the people who fact-check my book, all 12 historians, I all met them all on Twitter.
But also there's an emphasis on, I guess, the idea we think of history as being, or any sort of study as being, objective.
Yeah.
And there's much more focus nowadays on how that sort of objectivity can interact with the subjective experiences of the people that are being studied. I mean, obviously, in a slightly, you know, slightly more nuanced way than history is always written by the winners, you know, that old canard. History is inevitably going to be written by somebody with a particular perspective and also modern ideas and a modern take, and they're looking at something that happened a long time ago when people were very different and thought very differently from it.
What's really interesting, I think, to a certain extent, is to remember that history and the past are different. The past is what happened, and it's gone, and it doesn't change. It remains unknown to us, and also immutable. It won't change, it won't evolve, it won't be tweaked. You can't get at it. History, of course, is constantly changing, and that's a strange thing to get across to us sometimes, because we use the word history interchangeably with the past.
Yeah.
We talk about things that happened in history, historical events, but actually history is more of the pursuit of knowledge. So it's like science, really. History is more the discipline by which you try and understand what's going on. So historians rewrite history constantly. We are constantly doing it. Every time you sit down to write a new book or put forward a new theory, you are rewriting history. It doesn't mean you're rewriting the past, because you can't change the past. That's gone, that's locked. But we have this problem. We're trying to get back to the past. That's what we do. We're trying to work out effectively what happened and why, and you know, what were the ramifications. And in that sense, I tend to use this very clunky analogy. I say we're a bit like Columbo, you know, instead of a TV detective, we're kind of Sherlock Holmes, really. The problem we have is we don't have any witnesses. We don't get to interrogate anyone. And you don't get a confession either. At the end of the episode, you know, Columbo would always be like, why did he do the murder? And they're like, well, he slept with my sister. We don't get that in history. You can yell all you want at Alexander the Great, or you can dig up Richard III, you can have him right in front of you, but he won't tell you if he murdered the princes in the tower. So there's an inherent frustration that you don't get, I think, in science, perhaps, with history, is that there is no right answer at the end of the day. So what that gives you, of course, is a discipline predicated on people just arguing all the time, because you never can go, all right, case solved, we've proved it, done, you know, done, dusted. But the tremendously vibrant, healthy thing about history is exactly that at the same time, is that every generation rewrites its history based on, as you said, the things that it's interested in now. And so I think history in some regards is more of a mirror image to our own society than it is about the past. I think you can say so much about a society based on the kind of history they wrote and read at the time. You know, I probably call myself a social historian if I had to label myself. And social history is a very modern thing. It was sort of invented in the 1950s, more or less, you know, the history of the working classes and you know, these books that started to look at the impact of the mills and the Industrial Revolution. And that's a byproduct of Marxism and the idea that actually history is not a vast... It's not just this huge tapestry of great men with lovely moustaches doing great things, leading great wars. Actually, history is about enormous amounts of people being party to and part of gradual change sometimes, sometimes reverse change where things went backwards, sometimes nothing changed at all. But actually, that is what history is, really. It's about billions and billions of people being part of this huge ocean of stuff. And so, as a social historian, you start to go, OK, all right, well, that's interesting, because... I always thought it was 1066 and Magna Carta, but actually maybe it's more about loom workers in 1820s Manchester. And I think now there's a new generation of scholars who are interested in the history of sexuality and what you might call queer theory, you know, the history of homosexuality or lesbianism or bisexuality or asexuality. We're interested in the history of people with disabilities. We're interested in the history of deafness or of... There's a historian who's interested in the history of emotions, who I talk to on Twitter sometimes. You know, the history of emotions is a... On one hand, you kind of think, what does that mean? But actually, of course, it's one of the most human things about... you know, emotions are so important to our life, of course. So why not study them? Why not create a category of study that is the history of emotions?
But it's also one of those things that's so familiar to us that it seems weird to think that people might have behaved differently or experienced emotions differently in the past.
Yeah, and I think the problem is that sometimes we forgot to ask. We forgot to even sort of step back and say, I wonder if people in the 16th century cared as much about their kids as we do. And you go and look at it and you realise, yeah, they did, of course they did. They love their kids. But their attitudes perhaps to punishment might be different, or maybe their attitudes to infant mortality might be different, because so many children died of early early diseases that perhaps they had a coping mechanism to deal with that. Perhaps it was so common to see dead children that you just found a way of processing. You know, we don't know. So you go, you interrogate the sources, you start to ask these questions. But you're absolutely right that there are some things that we take for granted sometimes or we don't stop to think about. That was sort of one of the reasons I wrote the book, really, was that I got so many examples of people coming up to me and saying, people in the Stone Age were a bit stupid, weren't they? Why didn't they have cars? And you think, oh. Well, I mean, lots of reasons, but actually they weren't stupid. They just didn't... They hadn't got around to cars yet. They were just like us. They were as intellectually capable as us. They had all of the biological and physical capabilities that we do. They had language and the ability to love and mourn. They could laugh and smile. They could paint. They could do poetry. They were absolutely human, but they just hadn't got around to gas or combustion engines yet. You know, they were still working out how to do shoes. So one of the inspiring... motivating quests, I suppose, behind trying to get this book off the ground was thinking, okay, what would people in the Stone Age make of our lives, and what would we make of their lives, you know, and how did we get here from there? What's the journey that takes you from a million years ago all the way up to now? And is there something innately human in every society, or did every society kind of reinvent the wheel, so to speak?
From the 9th to the 15th of February 2015, Resonance 104.4 FM hosts its annual fundraising week. You can support us by attending one of our events, bidding in the auctions, or by making a donation. We aim to raise £50,000 this year, which will allow us to trial a DAB service, overhaul our website, and extend the range of our FM broadcast beyond central London. If every listener gave £1, we'd have secured our future for the next decade. For more details, listen at 104.4 FM in London, or go to fundraiser.resonance.fm.
I'm Irving Finkel, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So the book has a million years in the day, it's called, and it has a conceit, an idea. Tell us what that is.
Well, structurally, the book is set around a modern Saturday. So it's effectively a kind of day in your life, and, a modern Saturday in a modern Western world. And each chapter is a different subject, and each chapter is sort of a different hour of the day, to a certain extent, not quite, but you wake up in bed, and the first thing you do, of course, is you look at your alarm clock. That's what we all do. You look at the clock and you desperately hope it's wrong and you think, oh, I get 2 more hours sleep. But of course, it never is wrong. And so it's about the history of timekeeping. So chapter one begins straight away with, how do you tell the time? Because it's one of those questions that people don't really ask very often.
Yeah.
But actually, it's so integral to our life. We're obsessed with time. We all walk around with little watches and boxes of electronic timekeeping. And our lives are governed by the architecture of time. It never stops for us. And yet, actually, time is one of those weird things that humans have invented.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't exist independently. I mean, it does in terms of physics. You know, mm-hmm. in a universal sense, it's a constant thing that moves forward. Whatever. I don't know the physics. I'm not Brian Cox, but time is there. But we measure it through our own cultural ways of doing
yeah.
so. And what was really interesting is every society in history has struggled with telling the time. And they've come at it from different points of views, and sometimes they've used different technologies, and sometimes they've used different rubric. So we have the 24-hour day, which feels modern because we use it every day, and why wouldn't it feel modern? But it's based on the mathematics of Babylonia from 4,500 years ago, because they had a geodecimal mathematical system. Their maths was based on the number 12 rather than 10, because they thought 12 was the numerical cornerstone of the universe. They saw 12 moons across the year, and they thought 12 was more divisible by, it's divisible by 2, 3, 4, 6, and 12 itself. Whereas 10, obviously, is divisible by 2, 5, and 10, but it's not as versatile. So for them, they thought 12, well, this is clearly the key number. So they had 60-minute hours and 60 seconds and 24 hours in a day. Mm-hmm. And for us to sort of be carrying that on, 5,000 years on, kind of weirdly clunky. You sort of think, well, have we not invented a better system than that? Are we still...
Well, people have invented worse systems, certainly, haven't they? People have not always followed that.
That's the thing.
24-hour clock system.
That's
Let's
right.
talk about some of those other weird
it's so,
systems.
So the interesting thing is that, I mean, in the early days, the other thing is, what defines a day and a night? Day and night.
Yeah.
One of the things I love about the English language is that we have so many words for so many things, and yet we really struggle with basic sometimes.
Yes.
So we use the word day to mean two different things. It means both 24 hours, a day, but it also means the bit where you've got the light outside, the opposite of which is night. So we have this one word that means two completely opposite things, and it's really, really confusing.
But there is a word.
There is a word. It's one of my favourite words. It's called nycthemeron, and that means 24 hours, and it's a lovely Greek word meaning day-night, day and night, literally. But other languages, they get on fire. They have, the Dutch, I think, have etmaal. So that lots and lots of other languages have this idea of a 24-hour day in opposition to the daylight hours, but we don't. So immediately we kind of get stuck by having not enough words to describe what you're trying to do. And the Romans struggled with the same too. The Romans tried to label the daylight hours against the kind of 24-hour day itself. So they had a civil day meant 24 hours, and they had a natural day was the daylight. And then they changed it in the 7th century, and then they changed it back again. So people have always been doing that, changing the labelling of things. And then in the 1700s, right at the end of that 1700s, we had the French Revolution. And it starts in 1789, and it is a very complicated thing. I mean, you can't describe it as just like poor people versus rich people. That's not what revolutions are. Part of the revolution actually really is this, there's a sort of intellectual energy behind it as well, this sense of empirical radicalism derived from Enlightenment philosophy. There's an awful lot of people in Europe at the time stroking their chins and sort of saying, we should be, we should be more modern, we should reject the Catholic ways of medieval Europe, we should be people like Voltaire and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. So when they get into power, the revolutionaries, they chop off Louis XVI's head, and they get rid of all the aristocracy, and they murder an awful lot of other people as well. And they're about 3 years into the revolution, and they finally decide in 1793 that they're going to try and reform the calendar as well. They're going to say, right, come on, let's get rid of all the tradition, let's start again, effectively from year zero. We'll have a new calendar. So they invent a decimal calendar and a decimal timekeeping system. So they have a 10-month year, and they rename all the months after February is called Fonteurs, which means the windy month, because it's quite windy. And they decide that the day will now be 10 hours long. And it'll have 10 hours, and then each hour will have 100 minutes, and each minute will be 100 seconds. And so they bring in this decimal calendar system, which is madness. And everyone sort of goes, what's happening? I don't understand what's happening. Why are you doing this to us? It's an idea first advanced by a guy called Jean-Charles de Bordas. It comes in for about a year and a half.
That is amazing, though, that they did have a go.
They really had a go. They really went for it. And people were walking about with special adapted clocks, watches with like two different faces, one with old time and new time. And you look at the clock on the wall, it would have three hands on it, one for the normal hour, one for... And so the French struggled with this for about a year and a half, 18 months or 14 months, depending on which calendar you were using. And then they went, oh, you know what, guys, this is not working. This is a disaster. Let's just ditch it. So this experiment is abandoned. And it's really interesting because you think... You kind of assume that as people go forward in history, they kind of get better at stuff.
Yeah.
But the French Revolution shows that a really good idea in theory can just be a nightmare to apply in practice. And actually, 24-hour clock, as ancient as it is, it sort of works. So we'll just kind of stick with it. So it's a compromise.
You briefly alluded to this, but when is night? When is the morning? Because our morning, you know, we know 1 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And yet midnight means the middle of the night.
Yeah.
So our day does not start when it is light, which you would think would be the obvious.
It is weird. It's the Roman system that we kind of used. The Romans divided their day up into two sets of 12 hours, and we've kind of carried that on. But other societies, they were more interested in dusk and dawn than a sort of midnight cut-off point. And so they, certainly in Orthodox Judaism, for example, the Shabbat begins when the sun goes down on the Friday night.
Mm-hmm.
So it effectively runs through the end of one day into the next day, so it, or at least in terms of what we call an administrative day now. And the Babylonians similarly kind of had an interesting attitude to it. The Egyptians divided their day into four sections. They had a 10-hour window, and they had kind of half light. They kind of called dusk and dawn like this sort of mini period. So dusk and dawn got its own little window,
and that was just like an hour or something.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So they kind of. They were like, hey, the day's...
What you did then in those hours.
Well, yeah, so you're kind of looking up and going, hey, it's a little bit dark. It's not quite dark, but it's a little bit dark, so I'm just going to hang out. So every society kind of mucked about with it a little bit. And even there was a system in medieval Italy called Florentine Reckoning, where, again, it wasn't the same system that we have now. And so timekeeping is this kind of problem of what you do with time, where you draw the boundaries. Because nature itself just keeps going. It just is unrelenting. It just... The sun rises, it sets. It sets, it rises, it just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And so you have to kind of go, right, now, stop now, this bit, here, this is midnight. And so, as you say, we have this linguistic trip hazard in English where we say, I've been up all night party. And the problem is... The day begins at 00:00, you know, and 1 second. That is the new day. So you haven't been up all night partying, or maybe you have, but it's now a new day. So it's funny how much we struggle with language and the actual administration of time itself, the way in which you actually go about trying to set rules on when stuff starts and stops. And the amazing example of this, the thing that I really like telling people about, is the fact that we were still struggling with this in the 20th century. We were still having major issues with it, particularly in America. Because in about 1907, 1908, there was a guy called William Willett who invented daylight saving time, really. And he wasn't the first to come up with the idea. There was actually a chap from New Zealand, a New Zealander called George Huzzon, I think. And he'd come up with the idea, but no one listened to him. They kind of ignored him. So then William Willett independently came up with the idea while he was out riding in Kent, I think it was. He was on his horse, and it was very, very early in the morning, and no one was up.
Mm-hmm.
It was a beautiful sunny day, and he sort of noticed and said,
everybody's missing this.
Everyone's missing this lovely day. You know, I'm out having a lovely time, and all this wasted daylight. I wonder if there's a way of preserving this light for people when they're awake. And what he suggested was much more complicated, really. He wanted to restore the hour of light by moving the clocks back in the summer like we do, but he wanted to do it in tiny increments, so you had to move your clocks 8 times a year.
Mm-hmm.
So that was quite elaborate, and he was widely mocked for this. He was derided as a loony. In fact, he became a punchline. You know, he was sort of William Willett was like the end of a joke. He went from being this very respectable man, this English businessman, to being scientists were, you know, furious at him. They were incredibly angry letters written to the Times by these eminent scientists saying, this man is insane, we should never listen to him. But I think people were responding to it because in the 19th century, people had really struggled with timekeeping because, obviously, the sun rises and sets at different times, depending on where you are in the country.
Well, we should probably say that, you know, we've been talking about eons-long battle to tell time.
Yeah.
But it's also relatively late that it mattered. Like, you know, for most of human history,
it's
not been that big a deal. As long as we could watch the season, that was okay. But it's only once we get to the Industrial Revolution, and then once the world starts to become a much smaller place, you know, we'll obviously talk about the trains, which is the thing that sort of brings it in, that it actually really mattered.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think the Romans weren't bothered about time at all, really. They seem to have had very minimal interest in the idea of hours. You know, for them it was like morning, afternoon, bedtime. That was pretty much it. We know that in early medieval Europe, it's the hours of prayer the monks did They're called the canonical hours, and they're still, you know, Catholic, still monks and so forth still have them, you know, the Vespers and Compline and so forth allowed. And those were signalled by bells for the monks and nuns, so that you'd get up at 3 a.m, 6 a.m, 9 a.m, 12, all the way through the day doing these various prayers. And they were signalled by bells, and so that was the first time probably that medieval peasants actually had an understanding of time elapsing, because they would hear the bells and go, oh, okay, 3 hours has passed. But the actual clock itself as an invention, a public clock, didn't really reach Europe until the 1200s. And they were very clunky. They'd be put in these huge, beautiful bell towers, but they were really badly designed and they lost a huge amount of time. They're very inaccurate, very expensive to build. And then in the 14th century, you get this revolutionary movement where Islamic scientists in Syria comes up with a way of aligning his kind of astrolabe to the polar longitude, latitude, and so forth. So he can actually get equal hours. Because until that time, this is a very strange thing to get your head around, until that time an hour was longer in the summer than it was in the winter, which is very hard to explain to people, but it's because at the time people thought that the sun orbited the Earth, so that's immediately an issue. They thought that the sun was lower in the winter and then rose up and then came, yeah, so it sort of orbited around the Earth, but not around the equator, but rather a kind of ecliptic plane, almost. And so they saw that in the summer, your hour was about 75 minutes long, and in the winter, it was 45 minutes long. So it's only in the 14th century that in the Muslim world, you get this evolution of scientific understanding that says, hang on a minute, no, we can actually create 60-minute hours. So let's apply that. And then you start to see in the 14th century in Europe, these ideas coming in, 60-minute hours coming in, and increased trade and better timekeeping then gives birth to a new type of timekeeping, which then gives birth to a more kind of commercialism. And then in the 1600s, you get Galileo discovering the pendulum effect, and that ends up in being incorporated into clocks, because the pendulum, it's known as the seconds pendulum. It can swing for an exact second, which gives you much better timekeeping, which is when they invent the grandfather clock. And the grandfather clock, you know, is this lovely, beautiful clock encased in wood. You can put it in your house. So suddenly you now have accurate timekeeping that people can have in their home. So in the 17th century, people start to have time in their houses. It's not just in the public square anymore. It's not just sort of civic time. It's now personal time. But you're absolutely right that actually the importance of national time is really a 19th century invention, the Industrial Revolution, because it's the trains and telegraphs making the world much smaller than it was before. It's the speed of communication. And the key thing there is, as the evolution of the train system, to come back to William Willett, actually, he'd been putting forward this case in 1908 or so, saying, look, let's all change our clocks 8 times a year, it's going to be fantastically good fun, you know, we'll do tiny increments of 15 minutes. And people are saying, no, that sounds madness, why would we do that? We've only just set on a uniform time. And what they meant by that was London was 9 minutes ahead of Bristol because the sun rose, you know, later in the west than it did in the east. So you would get on a train from London to Bristol and you would arrive 9 minutes early, but not early because you were... Everyone else was... So your clock was wrong when you arrived. And people would look at you and go, well, no, it's 4 o'clock. What are you talking about? So there was this enormous problem that because of the speed of trains and then the telegraph machine as well, that suddenly different places were on different time systems. And so it got really, really elaborate and really complicated. And so they brought in railway time, which is this uniform time across Britain. And then it became standardised across the whole world in the 1880s, I think it is, where people went, right, Greenwich Mean Time is the... That's the set time, and they then created our system of 15 degrees of longitude to create time zones across the world, and America ended up with 5 time zones, and we had 1. So the Industrial Revolution forces humanity to deal with time in a much more interesting way. And then William Willett says, aha, brilliant, lovely, now we've mastered time, let's use it for our own purposes, let's harness it like you would an ox in your field, let's have more sunlight. And some people saying, no, that's a crazy idea. Why would we do that? And then he died, and then the Germans decided that actually was a great idea. Because it was 1915, the First World War was raging on, and the Germans realised that actually, if you adopted the system, you'd have a whole extra hour of daylight, during which time you wouldn't have to be burning all that fuel for light and heat, because it would still be daylight. And all that fuel could then go to the war effort. So the Germans were like, this is brilliant, we'll adopt it, we'll put all that fuel to the war effort, we'll win the war. And so a month later, Britain went, oh, hang on a minute, the Germans have adopted this system, and it's a British system, and it's terribly embarrassing, but we should probably do something about it. And so they then adopted the system. So Willett had died literally a few months ago, a complete laughingstock. Suddenly now his idea is being adopted across the world, it's being picked up in Australia and America and Canada and Germany and Britain. And so suddenly daylight saving time is this new hot thing. They get rid of Willett's idea of doing tiny increments. They just do 1 hour. They just say, right, the clock's forward at 1 hour, that'll make sense. The massive problem then in America is too big. So it's got all these time zones. Because of Sanford Fleming, this railway engineer who's put forward this idea of having time zones at 15 degrees of longitude, they have more than one time zone. And so the American government says, okay, guys, we're a federal nation. I tell you what, instead of having national time, because that's madness, it's not going to work, because it'll be dark in California and it'll be light in New York, let's have federal time where you'll get to decide what time you're in. And the problem is the states then said to the cities and towns, guys, you can decide as well. You can opt in or opt out of daylight saving time. And so you ended up with an entire nation opting in or opting out of daylight saving time on a whim, depending on where you were. And in the 1960s, until 1966, there were entire places where you could be in a different time zone if you stepped across the road. Idaho, for example, famously, there were shops in the same street that were on different time zones. It would be 9 a.m. in the corner store, and if you wanted to buy some milk next door, it would be 10 a.m. there. And so it was this sort of chaotic system. So chaotic, in fact, there was a stretch of road, there was a bus route between Steubenville and Moundsville. It's a 35-mile bus route. So you probably did it in, I don't know, 40 minutes or something. During that time, you went through 7 time zones. And that's just madness. Obviously, that's absolute madness. But this is the problem, is that because towns, cities, states were all on different time and they got to decide themselves, there was this complete lack of any kind of sense or logic to it. And so that persisted until 1966. But amazingly, I discovered this week, America was still trying to work out daylight saving time in 2007. Obama passed the legislation 7 years ago or something, trying to work out how many months there should be daylight saving time. So America is still trying to work out how many hours there should be of light, how many of darkness. You know, so time is this thing that still bedevils us. And actually, every year in British Parliament, there are still politicians who stand up and say we should have more daylight saving time or less daylight saving time. And people stand up and say no, because it causes more road deaths in Scotland because it's darker for an extra hour. So time is this constant argument, and it has been for thousands of years.
To Little Atoms, I'm Neil Denny, and today I'm talking to Greg Jenner, and we're talking about his book A Million Years in a Day, A Curious History of Everyday Life from the Stone Age to the Phone Age. And Greg, we've gone up, the alarm clock's gone up, and we're out of bed, desperate for the loo. So
yeah.
Talk about the history of the growth of the gradual need for a organised system of sewers, I guess.
Yeah.
Where did we first start having, you know, a collective need to manage our own waste?
It's a good question. It's one of the great questions of civilisation, is where do you put all the crap?
Mm.
Because humans produce a lot of it. We urinate several times a day. We defecate at least once a day if you're healthy. And of course, if you've got a community of 10,000 people, which is a modest-sized town, that's a huge amount of waste every day and over a year, you know. It's really going to pile up. Ironically, in the Neolithic, they literally did pile up. That's pretty much the answer initially in Catalhoyuk in Turkey, which is the first town. It's about 9,000 years old. They literally just piled it up next to their houses. A huge midden pile that someone presumably had to go up and rake every now and then. So,
midden is such a lovely word.
It's a lovely, very nice sort of Anglo-Saxon word, isn't it, midden? But actually, when you think about it, a steaming pile of crap is not quite as delightful. And so that wasn't a very effective system. That's undoubtedly led to a very high level of disease. And so you then see a sea change against that when you get the emergence of the much more sophisticated Bronze Age. So the Neolithic is people settling down for the first time. It's the farming revolution. It's people settling in a landscape, building towns, domesticating animals, growing their crops and creating communities. The Bronze Age is when that extends into a much more of a trade network, where you have towns and cities, actually very powerful cities, and in those cities there are more of a stratified hierarchy. You've got reigning monarchs, there are castes of people, there are priests, perhaps, and even maybe hierarchy of working labourers. So, you know, the Bronze Age is where you get modern life as we know it now, really. And in Bronze Age Pakistan, they are the first people to really come up with a solution to this poo problem. So the Harappans, they're called the Harappan civilization. They built a sort of network of various cities, quite a lot of cities, and they're named after the first one to be excavated. So Harappa was the first to be discovered and excavated. And they had a fantastically civilized sanitation infrastructure. They had subterranean, or maybe not quite subterranean, but they had essentially sewer channels that ran across the whole city network, and each home was connected to them. So you would have runoff pipes from upstairs and downstairs, and you could have toilets emptying into them that would be manually flushed with water. You know, you tip water in yourself, but you'd still be flushing down into a sewer, which is tremendously advanced. And this meant that, of course, all the effluent was taken away from the homes and houses and out to much safer territory, away into cesspits, away from where people were eating and sleeping and drinking. So it's much, much healthier. And then, of course, they also had a huge number of wells and water resources where they could get clean drinking water. So they kept their drinking water and their sewage separate, which is a brilliant idea. And bizarrely, actually, the Harappans pretty much were the height of sanitation infrastructure.
They keep cropping up through the book. I've never heard of these
people. Yeah, they're really interesting. It's what's, you know, you might call the Indus Valley. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, obviously at the time there is no Pakistan, it's sort of the Indian subcontinent, but they're the Indus Valley, and they kind of got it really early on. This is about 4,500 years ago. Mm-hmm. They're around the same time as Egypt. And their standard of hygiene and sanitation was unmatched, really, until the 19th century. You know, the Romans didn't get as close. Really. Mm. I mean, the Romans had underground sewers. They had Rome itself had extraordinary, this huge underground sewer system that was so big you could sail a boat through it. But it didn't really connect to all the houses, and it was obviously the capital city itself, but other cities in the empire didn't have it. So the Harappans got there very early, and then bizarrely, no one really ever matched that standard again until, really, Basil Jett in the 19th century invented the underground intersecting sewer system. So it's this bizarre thing. You assume history gets better, like people progress and evolve and learn their lessons, but actually you kind of want to go back 4,500 years if you need a poo. You know, if you get in a time machine and you need a poo, that's sort of where you want to go, actually.
For centuries, there's been people collecting people's effluents. Industries built around using that for other purposes.
Yeah, it's one of those things that Horrible Histories, the programme I, you know, spent 6 years making. Obviously, kids love all the poo and wee facts. But actually, they're really interesting. They're really important, because you're absolutely right. I think we forget that waste products were once tremendously useful fertilisers or medical products. So the Greeks had people called coprologoi, who were poo collectors. That was their job. They would, you know, dig it out and sell it to the farmers as fertiliser for the fields, and they would grow the food, and you'd eat the food and poo it out and start again. You know, it's a sort of it's a lovely cycle. And the Romans, they had quite large jars at the end of every street that you would urinate into, or you would bring down your potty and you'd empty the urine into it. And of course, urine was a fundamental part of the tanning process for making leather. It could be used in medicine. The Romans gargled mouthwash of urine imported all the way from Portugal.
So anything particularly good about Portuguese urine?
I'm not sure why Portugal. I've always wondered that, but no, apparently it was particularly strong. Apparently it was a sort of really, clearly there's something about the Portuguese diet or something that, you know, the Romans particularly approved of. So these waste products were a fundamental part of ordinary daily life, and the Egyptians, they cooked with excrement. They would dry it out and use it as fuel for their fire. The Anglo-Saxons were given cow crap for Christmas by their lords, you know, so if you're a peasant, you'd be given cow crap or sheep dung as an actual Christmas gift, as your bonus, and you could use it to make pottery, you could use it to repair the walls of your house, you know, wattle and daub. You know, it was really useful stuff. So I think we wrinkle our noses now and go, oh, you're disgusting. But actually, it was once rather useful, and so people have always found ways of employing it.
Well, also, moving on in the book slightly, one of the reasons why we often think of human waste in connection with disease and as a disease vector. But one of the interesting things that comes out of the book is the fact that, you know, people obviously used to have a much different relationship with hygiene and cleanliness. And in fact, amazingly, it seems that cleanliness was something that was frowned upon at some point.
Yeah, the weird thing is that, as you say, at different stages in human society, people kind of went, guys, we're not washing anymore. Agreed? And you sort of think, why? It's not a very good idea. But actually, there was a sort of sound empirical logic behind it. Or at least in one instance there was. The one that I tend to tell people most, I think, is that early Christianity rejected washing. So The early church fathers, like St. Jerome, they kind of said that washing was sinful because it's the sin of vanity and pride. And also, they'd been watching, you know, they'd been growing up in the Roman Empire. They kind of were surrounded by the Romans, going to their fantastically huge Roman baths, these vast complexes where they had hot water and cold water and steam baths, and everyone gets naked, and it's all rather... It's a little bit erotic. There's too much nudity going on. It's a bit too much fun. And so these early church fathers are like, well, we're not going to be Romans. We're not Romans. We're Christians. So whatever they do, we'll do the opposite. And so you end up, actually, bizarrely enough, with early Christian monks and nuns embracing something called ellusia, which is holy grime. It's this idea of sacred filth that you don't wash. And of course, ironically, Christianity is the only religion of the five major religions that doesn't have a policy on washing. In Islam, washing is absolutely fundamental. Absolutely, you've got to wash, you know, you've got to do it every time you go to the toilet. And so they found Christians disgusting and filthy. They were like, what are you doing? You haven't washed. And it's interesting that different societies at the same time found each other particularly, you know, the Saxons found the Vikings very, very clean. The Saxons were like, these Vikings wash at least once a week. What are they doing? And the Vikings would then go to the Byzantine world where they'd meet, you know, the kind of the Greek Romans, and they were washing even more. And then the Vikings would go and meet Muslim traders and merchants who'd say, these Vikings are filthy, they only wash once a week, what's going on here? So it's very interesting that at the same time in history, different people had different attitudes about how much washing should and shouldn't be done. But the really surprising story, I think, is that in the 1600s, washing goes out of fashion for a scientific reason. It's nothing to do with sin or vanity or nudity. It's this new kind of empiricism of early medicine where they're saying, well, okay, we think the body works by the skin is vulnerable to disease, you know, because of the 1600s is the great era of plague, and the sort of great thinkers are thinking, okay, well, clearly plague is getting in the body somehow. It must be getting in through the skin. So what you need, I think, is probably a good, healthy sheen of dirt to block up those vulnerable... You know, it's like the Death Star, when, you know, Luke Skywalker's trying to look for the little hole to put his proton torpedo in. It's the idea you need to block up all of your little vulnerabilities. And so you end up with these great early scientists, these fantastically clever men like Francis Bacon, coming up with these mad safety baths. So Bacon came up with a 26-hour safety bath, where he said, OK, if you need a bath, then you need to do it under medical supervision. And to do so, you need to sort of encase yourself in oils and saffron and pomanda and wrap yourself, and then you have to bathe in it for 26 hours. And only then are you safe from the water. And the King of France, Henry IV, sends for his finance minister, the Duke de Sully, and he gets a message back saying, oh, he'd love to come, but unfortunately he's in the bath. And the king says, oh my word, God, is he all right? God, I mean, guys, let's send everyone, let's make sure he's all right, because he's in the bath, he could die any minute, you know, this is dangerous. So you have this bizarre thing where everyone's running around terrified of washing. James I of England and Scotland, James VI of Scotland, James I of England, he refused to wash any part of his body apart from his fingertips. Because instead, what people did was this was the era of linen. Linen had come into fashion.
Yeah, I was going to say linen is introduced, and that also becomes a reason not to wash.
Well, that's it, because, I mean, linen's a very ancient fabric. We know that Ramesses the Great, when he was discovered, he was wrapped in linen. And actually, Tutankhamun was buried with 145 pairs of linen underpants, spare pants. So linen's a very ancient fabric, but in the 1600s, it comes in as this revolutionary new exciting fabric because you can wash it and kind of bleach it back to whiteness really easily. So the theory is, if you change your underwear all the time, you never need to wash beneath it. There's no need to wash. You just keep changing your underwear. Because they don't really understand... Well, they understand it, but they don't care about sweat. They're not bothered about the idea of you accumulating your own internal grossness. They just see dirt coming from an outside perspective. People smear themselves in sweet-smelling herbs and lavender, and, you know, they don't stink necessarily. It's not... I'm sure this is a time we would probably find obnoxious to our noses, because we're not used to that kind of smell. But they probably smelled of roses and lavender and herbs and so forth, because they're wearing as much of this sweet-smelling stuff as possible to do with this issue. But they're not washing particularly. Or at least certainly not the aristocracy. It's interesting, we don't know necessarily what the poor people are doing. Maybe they're just washing like normal, we don't know. But the aristocracy are being advised by their doctors, don't get in the bath, it's dangerous. And then, of course, you get, again, the revolutionary change away from this idea. In the 18th century, people start bathing again. They think it's good for you. They think water is... You know, people start pointing out, well, God put water on this earth. Clearly, he intended it for a reason. Maybe it's good for you. And then you get to the 19th century, and you have people sort of loving bathing, and you get the invention of the bathroom, which is a brand new room that's invented in the early 1800s, and the shower is invented in the late 1700s. And Sir Charles Dickens is one of the first people in London to have a brand new bathroom, and he has this state-of-the-art shower put in. So it's very funny. Every society in history has sort of had different attitudes mm-hmm. to hygiene and cleanliness. And actually, what defines clean determines an awful lot of, based on what you think of as cleanliness as an idea.
Yeah.
In Hinduism, cowpats are holy, they're sacred. So there's a very famous sociologist, he's an Indian campaigner for hygiene and so forth, but in his childhood he'd touched someone from the unclean caste of society, you know, an untouchable, and his grandmother had panicked because he'd touched someone, and she thought maybe he would catch their innate whatever it was that he wasn't allowed to be, and to cure him of this she made him gargle cow shit and cow urine. And to us we're thinking, how is that better? You know, how is that a cure for touching up? You know, it doesn't make any sense to us. But in their worldview, in that religious context, that was a cure for dirt. So dirt, for us, we might think of it, having watched lots and lots of adverts for, you know, detergents and mm-hmm. personal non-bio, we might think of dirt as bacteria. But actually, dirt is a cultural construct.
Yeah.
And every society has a different meaning for what dirt is. What is dirty and what is clean? Very much determined by who you are and where you're from.
If you love the art of listening to Resonance on the FM, go to the website and donate. Give some money and tell your mates. We want to go digital and upgrade. We're volunteers, we don't get paid. Show your love the way it counts. Send some money, any amount.
Resonance 104.4 FM Fundraising Week. The 9th to the 15th of February 2015. For more info, go to fundraiser.resonance.fm.
I'm Charlotte Higgins, and you're listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Let's skip forward a bit and get to a meal. And I want to talk about, well, food and drink, but not necessarily what we eat, but how we eat. How we've developed the rituals around eating together, the meal being a, you know, a thing where people come together and eat, and that's developed over a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think the surprising thing, perhaps, or maybe not surprising at all, but the crucial thing, I think, is that it's very, very old, I think, eating together. I mean, the evidence for it is difficult to find, because obviously you can't really find the archaeology of group sharing food, other than, of course, you'll find butchered carcasses of lots of meat in one place, and you can sort of say, right, okay, well, this is clearly a big meal was eaten here. And we know, for example, the Iron Age hill fort at Hambledon Hill, there seem to have been these big old parties, these huge parties where a lot of people would gather, a lot of animals were slaughtered, and they would eat a massive amount of food in one go, and then they would sod off again, and they weren't living there. There were no houses, there's no domestic buildings. It's pretty much a sort of party venue. It's almost like Glastonbury. Everyone turns up, has a great time, and heads home. So we know that there's archaeological evidence for these sort of feasting culture. And actually, I think a lot of anthropologists and paleontologists would probably say that, you know what, it's kind of crucial in the Ice Age, in the frozen times of the Stone Age, when people are very, very, they're struggling, of course, for survival against very difficult conditions. Mm-hmm. Eating together is probably a really integral part of community organisation, of keeping people together, of providing enough food for the weak and the vulnerable. Because we have archaeological evidence, for example, for those with perhaps disabilities, or people may have lost their teeth, who would have to be fed by others. They wouldn't necessarily be as good at hunting and gathering. They might not be as good at being able to chew. And yet we know that they're living into old age. They're being cared for. So mm-hmm. you can find evidence of care, mm-hmm. I think, and love going back a long time. And certainly, you know, look in the Roman world, they thought dining was very much a social custom. You know, the word, they called it convivium, living together, but also our word companion mm-hmm. derives from the Latin, someone you share your bread with. The idea that you break bread together, you share together, it's a very important thing. Mm-hmm. And the Babylonians in ancient Mesopotamia, they shared their salt and their oil and their wine, and this was a very important part of the meal. And, you know, if you struck a business deal, you would share oil with that person. So in the same way we would have a handshake when you strike a deal with someone, mm-hmm. say, I'll buy your car, shake your hand. For them, sharing food and wine or oil was this solemn ritual moment of saying, right, you know, this is us bonded now. Mm-hmm. So food has always had a very important part of that. And of course, mealtime, a bit a way of of orchestrating these kind of rituals. And of course, we still have these rituals. If you go for a meal with your friends in a pub or a restaurant, you know, let's throw a bit of money behind it. Let's go to a restaurant. You'll sit down at the table and you might find yourself just very momentarily wondering where you should sit.
Yeah.
You know, and if you should do a kind of boy-girl mm-hmm. thing, or who's going to sit at the head of the table. There might be a moment of panic where you think, all right, well, where... You know, and that's... We will laugh about it because it's with your friends and so forth. But these moments tell us an awful lot about the history of that etiquette. There used to be very, very strict rules about who sat next to whom. In Georgian society, you know, if you read Jane Austen novels, the order in which people get to sit down is really important. It's called the system of precedence.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all based on rank. So, you know, the sister of a duke outranks the wife of an earl. And, you know, and so you have this mad system where you may have 20 people around a dining table, but they don't sit down at the same time. They mm-hmm. sit down in order of who's more important than the next person. And so...
There's also, you talk about people have sat around a table, but there's some people at one end of the table who are definitely of lower status.
Mm.
And so it's not just that they sit down last, but they get different food. Like, they're literally made to know throughout the meal that you are of a lower
status.
That's
right. Yeah, in Roman banqueting, Roman banquets can be quite large. You can get sometimes 25, 30 people in. Mm. And Roman banquets are based in the triclinium system, where you have these low couches that you would lean sideways on. You might have two or three people sharing a couch, so they're effectively spooning each other. But the way in which they were orchestrated was kind of a U shape.
Mm-hmm.
So you might find yourself quite far away from the head of the guy throwing the party, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were quite far away, it's probably deliberate. You were probably put there because you're not very interesting or you're not very powerful. And you might well be served a second class. It's almost like being on a plane
mm-hmm.
and sort of having first class over there, and you can sort of see it. You can smell the delicious chicken that's being cooked, and then you get this rubbery lasagna. And you think, hang on a minute, why do I not get chicken? And it's that idea that actually you might be invited, but you were sort of an afterthought, and so actually the food was more of a... It would be paraded in front of you, and you'd sort of see it go past and think, oh, I kind of want that. So, yeah, there's this strange idea that we don't always necessarily serve the same food to our... You know, when we invite people to our parties, we would serve everyone the same thing,
yeah.
But actually that wasn't always the case. And in the 19th century, there was a tremendous problem with middle-class people maybe inviting people to their dinner party who were wealthier or more important
mm-hmm.
than them. And then you had a huge issue, because then you had to match their standards.
Mm-hmm.
So you had to make sure your servants and staff were good enough, and the food was good enough, and you know that you were allowed to talk to these people. So there's all sorts of really tense moments of panic and social awkwardness.
Accidentally talk to the wrong
Absolutely,
person.
Yeah, exactly. Hugely, hugely dangerous that you might talk to a duke without, you know, realizing. So it's funny, yeah, when you see people sit down together in a restaurant, or when you see them arguing about the bill, or trying to work out who pays what, a lot of these things go back a long time, actually.
There's lots more stuff that you cover in this book that we've not got time to look at, and
Sorry.
I want to finish off. It took us ages to get out of bed, but I want to go back to bed and finish off at the end of the book. And I want to talk about, again, this is something we don't necessarily think about that often, but just the evolution of the bed and
mm-hmm.
how we sleep and what position we sleep in and how long we sleep for. These are things that have changed a lot, again, over human history.
Yeah, the most surprising thing, I think, while researching the book was that archaeologists have very recently discovered the world's earliest evidence for beds. And it's really old. It's 77,000 years ago. And these are effectively mattresses woven from plant fibre in a cave in South Africa. And what had happened effectively is that the archaeologists have found burned layers of this vegetation. So what's going on is people clearly have woven a bed, slept in it for a while, and then it's got infested with insects, or they've dropped their dinner in it. And so they burn it and weave a new one. And so the archaeologists have found these sort of layers and layers and layers of previous beds that have been set fire to and a new one plonked on top. So that's really interesting, because you think, okay, cool, that's... Beds are old then, they're really old. And of course they are, well, why wouldn't they be? Humans need to sleep, it's a biological imperative.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow we don't imagine sleeping. We kind of think of beds as very modern, but they've always been there. And at Scarabrae in Orkney, we know that they had beds, sort of stone beds there. They look quite solid and quite sturdy, but they're proper actual beds. So that's 5,000 years ago, proper beds there. And in Egypt, as you say, the posture in the Egyptian beds, the aristocracy slept in elevated beds like we do, higher off the ground, and the poor slept in cushions on the floor. But the aristocracy slept in beds that sloped, weirdly. So they weren't horizontal like ours. They kind of sloped downwards, so they needed a footrest at the bottom to stop you sliding out. And you also slept on a hard pillow that was carved from stone or from mahogany or from antler or from bone. It was to protect your very complicated hairdo. So you didn't sleep on a comfy cushion like us. You would sleep on a kind of rigid, almost like an MRI machine or something. So that's quite weird, because you sort of think, actually, the peasants got off quite comfortably there. It sounds like they had the best time of it. And the Greeks, again, you know, Greeks and Romans, they, depending on how wealthy you are, you might sleep in a very low truckle bed, or you might sleep in just some hay, or you might sleep in a very expensive, beautifully carved bed. It's hard to know. We don't really have many Roman beds. And then in the Middle Ages, medieval beds could be, well, non-existent or very elaborate. You know, kings and queens, for example, had these beautiful, huge beds that could be dismantled and taken away, because kings and queens would be itinerant. They would, they would travel to different castles. So you would, like an IKEA bed, you would dismantle it and take it off with you and put it back together. But if you were living in a castle but you were part of the servants, or, you know, you worked at the kitchen, you would likely sleep amongst lots of other people, just in a heap in the middle of the great hall. You know, probably just throw down some hay sacks and you'd all sleep together. And we know this because strangely there were lovely travel books published for people who wanted to travel to other lands and learn the language and so forth, and so they would have guidebooks, phrase books, sort of saying, "Can you please stop kicking me in the face, please?" or "Stop snoring, you're annoying me," translated into Dutch or into French or into Italian or into English. So we know that people are having to sleep en masse with strangers. And bafflingly, even in the 1600s, 1700s, we know it in America, people are sleeping, not just a whole family in a bed, but strangers would get in with them. It's a practice called quiesting, which is a Dutch word, where if someone had visited the town and they didn't have enough room in the inn, they could pay to stay in the family bed with you. So you might have some bloke in town on business who would get in the bed with you and the kids, and he'd snuggle up under the warmth. And we know that we think that the nursery rhyme, "Ten in the bed, the little one said, roll over," comes from this tradition of pigging, which is where a whole family would sleep in a bed, which was actually common in rural Ireland and Scotland until the 20th century.
Well, while we're here, we're quickly running out of time, but just tell us to finish off about the idea of bundling, which is a related phenomenon.
So bundling was a technique to try and stop people shagging, effectively. You would you might have a young couple who were courting, and so the parents were okay with a man visiting and staying in the house, and perhaps there wasn't a spare room yet, because this is a time when there aren't individual bedrooms, but there isn't. You don't want them sleeping next to each other in the same bed, so they would do this thing called bundling, where they'd effectively put them in straitjackets. So you'd be lying next to each other in bed. You would sleep together, but you would be effectively straitjacketed, and then they'd put a bundling board between you, like a large wooden board dropped down between you. So you couldn't see each other, and you couldn't touch each other, and you were technically sharing a bed. And it was sort of a technique to try and prevent premarital sex. It wasn't that effective, because we know that about 30% of people who got married in the 18th century were already pregnant by the time they got to their wedding day. So actually, maybe it wasn't that good. But, you know, it's worth a try, isn't it?
That's where we'll have to leave it. So I've been talking to Greg Jenner, and we've been talking about his book, A Million Years in a Day, A Curious History of Everyday Life from the Stone Age to the Phone Age. Greg, thank you very much for coming in and telling me about it.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
The show is supported by 89UP and hosted by Positive Internet. You can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
You can find old interviews, some great journalism and more on our relaunched website, littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.